My name is Melissa Hale, and I'm the coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Once again, we are delivering the Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum to you online. We hope at some stage to be able to deliver the series face to face when it's safe to do so in an inclusive and accessible way. However, we hope you've all settled in comfortably and are ready for our fantastic series this week. We encourage your active participation today. So please type your questions in the Q&A box, and at the end of the session, I'll be facilitating a Q&A session with our presenter. The first cab off the rank for this series is around counselling and advocacy support for the Disability Royal Commission. The important work of the Disability Royal Commission is bringing to light the deeply rooted systemic abuse facing people with disability. As we have heard, the abuse is happening in all areas of life, in the home, in education and employment settings, and within the health and services system. Almost more confronting than the abuse itself is the apparent indifference of people in power and the general public more broadly, who have allowed the abuse to continue. Despite lifetimes of not being heard, people with disability are being asked to step up and tell their stories in the hope that this time they will be believed and that things will change. To do this, people with disability need support. And let's not forget the vicarious trauma that people supporting them with telling their stories often experience too. To step us through what's available, please welcome Dr. Cathy Kesselman from Blue Knot Foundation and Mary Mallett from Disability Advocacy Network Australia.
Melissa, did you want me to start now? Thanks. And apologies. Thank you. Apologies in advance. My internet connection is not very stable today, so hopefully it keeps going. I'm Mary Mallett. I'm the CEO of DANA, Disability Advocacy Network Australia. That's who DANA is, and we're heading for the next year and a half until the Royal Commission for Commission. So I thought I'd just let you know who are the other national peaks that are funded by DSS, Department of Social Services, to do this work. DANA is funded for coordination activities. It's slightly different to the expectations for the other organisations who are primarily funded for systemic advocacy on Royal Commission issues. So, Children and Young People with Disabilities Australia, that's CIDA, NEDA, National Ethnic Disability Alliance, AFDO, Australian Federation of Disability Organisations, Women with Disabilities Australia, People with Disabilities Australia, and First Peoples Disability Network and Inclusion Australia, who are the representative organisation for people with intellectual disability and their families. So that's the group of national peaks that are funded to do this work. And then the other funding by DSS. So DSS is funding the advocacy support and also the counselling support for the Royal Commission, and Cathy Kesselman's going to speak to you about the counselling after me. And so there are 50 of the advocacy organisations that are funded through the NDAP, the National Disability Advocacy Program. 50 of those around the country are funded for Royal Commission advocacy, and that funding is particularly to provide advocacy support for people with a disability who want to tell their story to the Royal Commission. Then there's a group of disability-specific national peaks who are funded through AFDO, Deaf Australia, Blind Citizens, Down Syndrome Australia. There's a number of others who are funded to do some work with their cohort of people with disability. And there are 40 other smaller disabled peoples and families organisations and a few of the state-funded advocacy organisations who are funded much smaller amounts, which is distributed through DANA. And that's about promoting the Royal Commission to their stakeholders. And they're doing quite a range of activities with their relatively small amounts of money. But the advocacy funding, the what you'll hear about mainly is that funding to the NDAP organisation. So these NDAP Royal Commission advocacy. So this is what that advocacy is for. So it's primarily, of course, aimed at people with disability, but it can be for family members or carers who are acting with or on behalf of the person. And it's for people who need assistance because they have difficulty in engaging with the Royal Commission themselves. They have problems in communicating perhaps or understanding how to engage with the Commission. The Royal Commission has a 1-800 number. It has a team of people who can speak to people if they want to tell their story directly to the Royal Commission. And some people are very happy to do that. Generally, the advocates are working with people who wouldn't do that by themselves. So an advocate will be able to help people to understand how to tell their story to the Royal Commission, how to work out some of the problems or avoid some discriminatory issues that they're currently experiencing, find communication supports, including interpreters if they require them, and access other supports, particularly legal services and, in some cases, financial services. One of the things that has arisen is that some of the people who come forward to the advocacy organisations to tell their story to the Royal Commission, they have existing live current advocacy issues that they need help with. And that's has been and still is a dilemma for advocacy organisations, many of whom are at capacity and have waiting lists. And they have, within the funding guidelines from DSS, they are allowed to work with those people on other advocacy issues, but it doesn't mean that they have the time to do it. And anyway, that's an ongoing problem for some of the advocates. There are 1,081 people were helped under this Royal Commission advocacy funding in 2020. Now, what that's the figure from DSS through their data that they gather from the advocacy organisations. What we don't know is how many of those people went on to make a submission. So some of them may have come to an advocate for help to write their story and tell it to the Royal Commission and may have, in the end, may have decided not to do that. Now, DSS can't tell from their data about that, so we will be trying to find out from the advocacy organisations this year about that, of the people who come to you for advocacy assistance, how many end up putting in a submission to the Royal Commission and how many just make a decision that it's really not for them or that this is, it's not the right timing or they just don't want to do it. This Royal Commission is different from the Child Sexual Abuse Royal Commission because there is no there's no redress scheme as part of this commission. So certainly at the moment, there's no sense that people will get recompensed, at least financially in any way, for the harm that's been done to them that they tell this Royal Commission about. So people are making a decision to tell their story because they want what happened to them to not happen to other people. And for some people that's sufficient, and for other people they decide that it's too hard and that they just choose not to do it. One of the other things that in the legal services, what advocates can connect to is the other part, the other support service that is actually funded for the Royal Commission is the Your Story Legal Support. And that's funded by Attorney General's Department, not by DSS. And that's the legal aid. It's run out of Sydney, but it operates nationally, and it's run through the legal aid commissions and the Aboriginal Legal Services. And when an advocate's working with somebody about putting their submission together, they can contact Your Story Legal Service and talk through with them what are there any potential legal ramifications out of the person telling their story. In particular, if the person wants to name an individual or an organization, then it's useful for them to get legal advice about whether that's, well, about what they should think about when they make that decision. And that's what Your Story Legal Service will help them do. The work that Dana's been doing on the Royal Commission, which is a lot of it's to do with information provision. So on the Dana website, there's lots of information and resources about the Royal Commission itself and how it's working. But also, we keep an eye on a whole lot of the work that a lot of the advocacy organisations are doing, and we take examples and put them up on the Dana website so that people can get a really good overview of how the advocacy sector is working in relation to the Royal Commission. We created a Slack channel for advocates. If you're interested in being part of that, that's one that's particularly around the Royal Commission issues, then you can email Siobhan, who's our policy officer, on policy@dana.org.au to join that. And the same if you want to subscribe to our Royal Commission e-news. We have a separate ordinary Dana e-news that comes out every now and then, but the Royal Commission e-news focuses just completely on Royal Commission issues. And the thing we do is on social media is try and keep sharing and making available as much as we can the information about the Royal Commission issues on Facebook and Twitter is mainly sorry, I can see that my freezing every now. I think it means that I'm dropping out times. So apologies if this is a bit disjointed. In the Royal Commission has put out their interim report. And advocacy, the word advocacy was mentioned 224 times, and the word advocate was mentioned 125 times. So advocacy is it's recognised by the Royal Commission as being really important. And in their emerging themes in that interim report, one of those was advocacy and representation. And then a couple of times mentioned advocacy from the hearing on group homes. One of the themes which is mentioned there was safety strategies, such as developing networks and trusted relationships with a range of people outside of the closed environment, as well as independent advocacy and self-advocacy. Sorry, another piece of work. I'll go back a second. This was one of their section on the hearing on health services for people with disability. Again, they mentioned strong advocacy. The importance of strong advocacy in ensuring people with cognitive disability are provided with quality health care. And in their areas for further inquiry, they talked about the means by which people with cognitive disability, their families, carers, and supporters can be treated in for health treatment, including independent self-advocacy. Those are just examples to that. In each area that the Royal Commission investigates, what they are seeing is it plays an essential role. And what the Royal Commission, we had a meeting with all the commissioners and the senior staff at the Royal Commission before Christmas with the other national peaks. And they said that they're going to pick up this year, they're going to pick up advocacy as one of the important issues they look at. It's not, they weren't completely clear about how they would do that, whether they would hold a specific hearing about advocacy or whether they would write a policy or an issues paper about it, but they do intend to look at it properly. And so it's really important this year that the advocacy sector puts forward to the Royal Commission the potential solutions that we can see that advocacy can play in, and that those last, you know, few questions I've got there for you, all of you to think about. What do we want to see in that, in the report when the final, the Royal Commission comes? What will we be hoping to see in it about advocacy and where it sits in the future? Obviously, there's going to be hundreds of recommendations about all of the other systems and how people are, with disability are treated in the other, in all of the systems. But and everybody will lose on those recommendations as well. The one that I'm, the one or the ones that I'm trying to focus on are the ones that are about advocacy and the funding of advocacy. And so we have to be able to, as a sector, we have to be able to put forward some really good, clear solutions, really, that the Royal Commission can pick up and grab as recommendations. So we have to be able to show how can and how do advocates prevent violence, abuse, neglect and exploitation, and what is their role in the protection and safeguarding of people. A huge question is, how do we meet the unmet need for advocacy? And that is about what amount of funding is required and what models of advocacy are required. You can see, you know, the final report from the Aged Care Commission has just come out. And the government came out immediately with a interim, so a very quick response at where they were putting some money as an immediate response. And then there will be, you know, they'll pay attention and put together other solutions as well. But it would be good, wouldn't it, that when the final report for the Royal, for the Disability Royal Commission came out, it would be nice to see if part of the immediate solution that governments would spend money on would be to do with advocacy. I think that all the advocacy sector believes that that's necessary, but we have to frame it in the right way. And so for any of you that are listening today and that are interested in helping to do some thinking about how do we put together the way and to which forms of advocacy. I think I've dropped out again. Sorry, I think I dropped out again for a minute there. But what I'm suggesting really is that any of you who are interested in being part of doing any of this work and thinking about these questions about advocacy and the solutions that we need to put forward, please get in touch with me at CEO@dana.org.au. You can get my contact details from Melissa if you're interested. And I would like to us to be able to work together on some of the solutions. And I think that's all. So that's how to contact us, through our websites and then Twitter and Facebook. Thanks, everyone. Over to you, Kathy.
Thank you, Mary. Apologies, everyone, the internet, what can we do? But I would like to introduce you now to Dr. Kathy Kuzelman from Blue Knot Foundation. Welcome, Kathy.
Thanks very much, Melissa, and it's always great to follow Mary. Mary's, just got a lot of experience, obviously, and a lot of wisdom in the space, and is a great leader. So. Just looking at this slide, I'm hoping the slides are going to be easy to read. But anyway, look, our organisation was funded to run the National Counselling and Referral Service, and that's quite a complicated name. but it's a service to which people with disability who have experienced violence, abuse, neglect or exploitation and or are engaging in the Disability Royal Commission can call. And so originally we were just set up to support people engaging with the Royal Commission, but our scope has been extended since then. And so who can call? People with disability, people who've been affected by COVID-19, and obviously this has been an incredibly challenging time for us all with, you know, so much uncertainty, with isolation, social distancing, lockdown, and we know that many people are impacted by COVID. And if that's impacting you, you can call the NCRS. Obviously, people engaging with or affected by the Disability Royal Commission, and people with instances of violence, abuse, neglect, exploitation, either currently or in the past. So it's really quite a broad brush, and we're very glad to see a lot more people coming forward and linking in with our service. Service isn't only for people with disability with their own experiences, but also for people who support them in a range of ways. So family members, carers, obviously advocates who we're speaking to today, and you know, thank you again for the invitation. If you need a referral for someone you're supporting, and if you need just some basic information about trauma and how it can affect people, because Blue Knot's expertise is around what we call complex trauma. So repeated trauma, usually between people, which is experienced either as a child, a young person, or an adult, and often, sadly, across the life cycle. And so we also support workers. We do have quite a lot of advocates calling, and I'll talk more about that later. And also service providers, so legal, financial services. So all the different services that have been set up to support the Disability Royal Commission, as well as other services that's outside of that who may be engaging with people with disability. We're also obviously able to provide counselling, but also referrals or warm transfers. And we know that many people ringing our service, you know, have many needs. And often we will spend a lot of time trying to find, you know, what are the best referrals, and often a number of them for people seeking our help. We provide short-term counselling, and often refer you on to longer-term counselling if that's what something that you're seeking. So, I mean, these words, you know, sadly, are bandied around a lot, and many of us know all too well what they mean, but I just thought I'd quickly sort of outline the scope of what's captured here. So when talking about violence and abuse, it's a range of behaviours towards people, from assault, sexual assault, restrictive practices, that's chemical, physical, humiliation, harassment, force, and of course financial and economic abuse, as well as significant violations that many people with disability experience to their privacy and to their dignity. In terms of neglect, when we talk about neglect, we're talking about both emotional and physical neglect, what someone doesn't receive. And that can either be passive because of things that are just simply not done, basic needs that are not met, or it can be intentional. And this can include depriving a person of, you know, simple things, but basic needs such as food and water, medical treatment, access, clothing, education. And by exploitation, we mean when a person is taking advantage of another person, withholding basic needs, withholding their access to work and to education, to assets, and taking advantage of them, including sexual, financial, and economic advantage. So, you know, sadly, many, many ways in which people can experience past or current violence, abuse, neglect, and exploitation. So what does the NCRS do? And, you know, counselling is quite a fancy term, but basically what it means is providing emotional support, is having a space where you can be listened to, heard, validated, and believed. And we know that many people who've called the NCRS have felt that for the very first time they've been deeply listened to, and that they've been met with where they are in the present. You know, what is it that they need right now? And even though it's short-term counselling, it's quite remarkable what one call to the service can mean for a lot of people, because sadly many people with disability have just not experienced that space of being, of feeling safe and being able to share as much or as little as they choose. Ours is a team-based service, which means that we have a number of counsellors who may pick up a call at any one time. So if people call a number of times, they may speak to a different counsellor. But the advantages of that are that means that you have different experience with someone who's, you know, very experienced in supporting people with trauma and disability. And also some notes are shared internally within the team. So if someone has called before, you don't need to start again, but you start from where you are on that day. The team is informed by disability and attuned as much as possible to diversity. And we know that human beings, we all bring a range of experiences and a range of barriers to full engagement. We offer counselling for up to an hour a week, and that can be in one session or it could be a number of times during the week. And our service has recently expanded to provide support to people in what we call closed institutions, so people in prison or in forensic mental health settings, or in juvenile justice. And what we're finding is that as we are really starting to engage with, you know, people in those centres, that it's, again, quite a remarkable experience of support and being heard that people have never experienced before. And for people who may have been in and out of those settings, just an understanding that, you know, maybe it's not about blaming themselves, but understanding, you know, how their experiences of violence or abuse in the past have actually meant that they haven't had the skills to be able to, you know, live the life that, you know, every person deserves and needs. And so we're finding that we're actually able to provide the emotional support that allows people to see the possibility of something different. A big part of what we do as well is provide referrals. And as I mentioned before, those referrals are as unique as we are as human beings with all our different needs. And so we seek to find out what it is that would really help someone, how we can, you know, help to refer to advocacy service for someone who's wanting to make a submission to the commission or to consider making a submission. People who may be ready to engage in longer-term counselling, because obviously ours is a short-term service, which can make a big difference in terms of showing the possibility of safety and trust. But for people who want to explore things in the longer term, that can be very helpful. And we also refer to the funded legal services and a whole range of other services, again, depending on the great diversity of needs of people calling the service. And what's been great to see over the time that the service is running is that really we're getting more and more people ringing every week. So we're now up to, you know, over 150 calls a week. And as I say, many of those calls can be up to an hour, you know, plus all of the referrals and the warm transfers. So supporting people to reach those other services, because often people can be given the name and a number of a referral, but it's incredibly difficult to follow up on your own. So we try very hard to support people in whatever process it is that they think would help them with their current needs. Sorry, I've just got to wake up my clicker here. So who are our counsellors? We have an amazing team, and I don't say that lightly. We have a team, and we're very particular about choosing people for the team. People really have to have a very nuanced understanding of what it means to have experienced repeated trauma at the hands of other people. And so they are trauma specialist counsellors. They're able to attune to the person in the present, what it is that person needs. They're trauma informed, and I'll talk more about that later, and that's a term that's overused. But what it means is that they are human in their responses. They're there to listen to the person, to focus on the person, not what the service needs or what anything else needs. And that's really critical. Obviously, disability focused, and again, we're not focused on the particular disability that someone presents, because we know that we all live with different barriers and diversity, but it's about understanding that. And as culturally sensitive as we can be, to understand that we all bring our own cultural backgrounds and different ways of being and feeling and understanding trauma and understanding healing. And that needs to be brought to every conversation we have, because if you're not culturally sensitive, it'll be very hard for a person to feel safe and to feel really understood, because people can only be understood in the context of where they've come from and what they've experienced. So how can you contact us? So by phone, and the number's there. We operate 9 to 6 Monday to Friday and 9 to 5 on weekends. And we do find that weekends can be quite busy. It seems to be a time where maybe people have the space and the ability to call. And we've tried to make the options as accessible as possible, so with a lot of choice. It's possible to do live chat, and you can access live chat from the Blue Knot website. And we can also set up video conferencing sessions as well. So as much choice as we're able to offer to enable accessibility, and also to give people the comfort of what is the best way for them to connect in the moment. So how private is my call? And it's very important to say that we don't record our calls. Because obviously privacy and confidentiality is absolutely critical for people calling, because without that, it's impossible to feel safe. It's important that it's up to you to make the decision of what you want to share with us at the time. No one prods or asks you to give any detail, particularly about the trauma that you've experienced. That's your choice. You don't need to use your own name. You can choose a pseudonym or a nickname if you choose. And just to say that even though we're funded by government, we work entirely independently of the Royal Commission and of government services. As I said before, we do take some brief notes, which are only shared within the team, because it is a team-based service. So if you were to call again, then you don't have to repeat what you've told us before, but those notes are entirely private and confidential within our service. So we mentioned the trauma-informed principles before. And as I say, they used so much that they have lost a bit of their meaning. But it's really about what it is as human beings that we all need to feel and all deserve and want to feel. We want to feel respected. We want to be treated with dignity. We want to feel safe. And obviously, you know, many people have never felt safe. And that's emotional and physical safety. So we do what we can to help people feel held within the service. Again, many people have been betrayed, and so it can take a long time to build a sense of trust, to know that we can be trusted, that what we say we will do, we will do. And if at times we screw up because we're human, that we own that and that we tell you, and then we work together with you to try and sort out how we can work through that. Very critical that, you know, everyone who calls and, you know, has choice because, again, many people who've been abused or experienced coercion have had no choice. So choice in how you access us, but choice also in when you call, when we call back, what it is you need. Collaboration. So abuse occurs in situations of a power imbalance. And many people who've experienced trauma living with disability have felt profoundly disempowered. And so how do we share power and work with you? Because you're the expert in your own experience. And how do we empower you to have a sense of autonomy and self-determination? And again, these words are spoken about a lot, but, you know, how do we do it genuinely and with connection and with meaning? Because the most critical part of the service that we offer is about our relationship. Because as human beings, that connection is what can aid healing, just as people have been harmed in relationships. So relationships of support and listening and understanding can promote healing. And that's what we seek to do. So what is counselling? Everyone can benefit from counselling. Many people think that it's, you know, it's for people with a mental illness or it's not for me, and that it's carried a sense of shame about the need to seek it, or that, you know, other needs get in the way. But I suppose the beauty of the NCRS is that we can offer free specialist counselling for people who need it. And as I say, it is tailored to people's needs. We try and attune to what it is that someone is telling us and what it is that you articulate that you need in the moment. It's a safe space, a space where you can share whatever thoughts, feelings, and experiences you feel comfortable to share in the moment. And that may change from call to call. As I say, you're not coerced to share anything you're not comfortable with. We can support you with the life challenges. As I say, COVID has created even more stress and anxiety for many of us. How can we support to hear what that's meant for you? And we can also, as I say, refer to you to longer-term counselling, which can really help to support healing from trauma. And it's very, very important to reassure you that healing from trauma, whatever that means for you, is absolutely possible. And we'll talk more about that later. This is about our support for people who are feeling impacted by COVID. And as I say, this is a time of enormous uncertainty. It's a time of threat, to our health, threat to the services that we've been able to access. And for people who've experienced trauma, who have experienced threat in the past and often lived in a time of danger, it means that we can be quite heightened. Our survival response, our fight, flight, freeze response can be accelerated, and you know, we can, what we can do is help to provide you with some tools that may help just to for you to settle down your nervous system, but to understand that it's not abnormal to be feeling like that, and to provide some basic education about survival responses and trauma responses, so that, you know, often find many people who've experienced trauma blame themselves and feel a sense of shame. And when people understand that they are experiencing reactions that, you know, many, many human beings experience under stress, that can take away some of that shame and self-blame and start to promote healing. So we do have a lot of advocates calling us, and just want to acknowledge the incredible work that you all do and the passion that, you know, I certainly know that, you know, so many advocates exhibit in the day for very challenging work, and for work that, you know, I'm very aware is so under-resourced as well. And so, again, to understand that the stress that you're under and the trauma of hearing other people's trauma, vicarious trauma, can actually start to impact you. And so we're more than happy for you to call the NCRS so we can help you to understand, you know, some of what you may be experiencing and put words around it, and again, give you strategies and tools to help you so that you may either, you know, take some time out of your work, put more breaks into your day, debrief with a peer, another advocate, various ways and strategies that you can be supported to care for your own well-being while you're doing this critical work. And that's a very, very important message. And to know again that there's no shame about, you know, saying that, you know, I'm really not coping today, I'm feeling too anxious, I'm feeling overwhelmed. That makes sense. It's part of a normal response to the nature of the work that that you're doing and to being to working with people who've experienced trauma. So trauma can, you know, sadly impact, you know, just about every aspect of someone's life, and I'm not here to bombard you with all of the impacts, but to know that understanding that many of the responses to trauma are responses that many other people have to trauma as well. And just that understanding of what happened to me in the past and making the connection between that, how I'm feeling now, how I've coped, but yet there are other ways of coping and being supported towards you know, a place of recovery and health. And very, very important part of the messaging. People can and do absolutely recover from trauma, but that recovery is very personal, it's very unique. It's not a medical definition of recovery. It's not about diagnosis. But what is very, very important is that even when it feels like there is no hope, to hold on to that hope and that possibility, not to deny or negate experience or barriers, but to know that there is a way forward. But for everyone, that's different because everyone is different and we all have different paths. So again, these are the numbers for contacting us. And I think I'm just aware of the time, pretty much done. Yeah, that's just a little bit about Blue Knot. But I think, thank you for listening. And I think we're going into a very brief Q&A now. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Kathy and Mary. That was very useful. 150 calls a week is a lot of calls. And I would just like to reiterate the importance of not underestimating the impact of trauma and the importance of self-care. And for advocates, you cannot pour from an empty cup. So it's really, really important to reach out for support when you need it. I think before we go to questions, the first thing I would like to highlight, there were a few questions before about whether slides would be available after this. Yes, the whole recording of this session, plus the slides associated with it, will be available on the Bdawi website as per usual. And the slides also have the really important phone numbers to call to get help if you need it, so please reach out. So we'll go to some questions and answers now. So we'll bring Mary and Kathy back on the screen. So first question, so few people with disabilities are stepping up as witnesses. Do you know why this is given, why this is given so much counselling and legal support? So who would like to tackle that question first? Mary?
I think there are some reasons. And the reasons are because the Royal Commission are wanting to select the cases, the stories, the people that will give the best evidence, the best the evidence that they can then use in their final report. Some of the people whose stories provide the best evidence, those people would have enormous difficulty in speaking up in a very formal setting like the Royal Commission. And so that's why it seems to sort of end up that it is their family members talking about them, or their advocates talking about them, or other people around them. It's not because I've seen you know, Senator Jordan Steele John and others making political points about, as if the Royal Commission don't want to hear from people with disability. I don't think that's true. I think they do want to hear from people with disability, but I think some of the very complex issues that they want to explore have happened to people who would find it very difficult to speak in that public way at those hearings. That's what I think it is.
Really interesting. Kathy, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I'm happy to. I think it's, probably for Mary.
So past Royal Commissions have focused on obtaining justice, writing wrongs, but this one is very forward focused instead. What are the benefits? Hang on, I can't see the screen. What are the benefits of a person with a disability telling their story to the commission when it's likely to re-traumatize them?
Yeah.
Who would like to tackle that one?
Yeah.
Kathy?
Thank you. Look, I think, you know, there's no single answer for every person. Every person would have their own reasons for speaking to the Royal Commission. Definitely acknowledge that there's no apparent immediate benefit, but some people may certainly find benefit from speaking out, being heard, and being heard by people in a position of authority, and also by being part of a movement for change, part of a movement that hopefully will see a real difference as a result. And our organisation was very involved with the Child Abuse Royal Commission, and certainly that was the case for many people who spoke to that commission, that, you know, they wanted to do what they could to make sure that what happened to them would never happen to someone else. And that was a big part of their motivation and a big part of, you know, what they felt that they got out of it.
Right, thank you. And next question. Often people with a disability don't want to make a complaint or report the abuse because they don't feel supported. Should safeguarding bodies be trained to be more trauma-informed or offer counselling to? The rest of the question will come up. I'm looking at a different screen. Yeah.
Yes, look, I mean, you know, our view is that everyone should be more trauma-informed, that the world needs to be more trauma-informed. So absolutely there needs to be much greater training for safeguarding bodies and, yeah, offering of you know, a diversity of support so that there's choice and places to go, that people can be, you know, held and made and supported to feel as safe as they can during a process that's incredibly challenging.
Right, thank you. And there was one last question I would like to ask, but I don't know whether it's enough time to put it up on the screen. Oh, perfect. Thank you for this informative presentation. Are any of the advocacy organisations funded to undertake outreach into closed environments? For example, SRS, mental health inpatient units, custodial facilities, etc. Mary?
So there hasn't been specific funding for that, but some advocacy organisations are trying to find ways in to those places. So there is a little bit of work, but for a lot of organisations, they've already been reached out to by lots of people, and so their capacity is fairly full. But there is some work. Very happy if anybody wants to come back to talk to me separately about that afterwards. But yes, there are little pockets of work in that way happening around the country. There's been some in Queensland. I'm not so sure about Victoria actually. I should check a bit more.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much to both of you. Mary, thank you very much for your presentation, particularly on what's happening in the advocacy sector around the Disability Royal Commission, and Kathy about all the services for counselling that Blue Knot offers as well. I think we're all really looking forward to seeing what the Disability Royal Commission comes up with, and more importantly, what changes it can make to the lives of people with disabilities as well. So thank you very, very much for your time today. Everybody, we've come to a close of the first of a very exciting week. So thank you to everyone who came today. Thank you to the Auslan interpreters and captioners for your hard work today. Thank you to Show Division for bringing this production to us today. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and we'll see you next time.